May I have your attention for an announcement, please? Tonight, the part of Robin Williams will be played by Don Ho. Ladies and gentlemen, will you please welcome Mr. Robin Williams?
I wish to begin by showing you something that I am very proud of. I know. I'll have to ask these people to move back, though. You're disarming me. Well, obviously, you are on drugs, yeah? It's okay. Don't be afraid. I would like to begin by doing some basic Soviet suppressions for you. My first suppression is Karl Marx, and for those of you on drugs, Karl Marx. Karl Marx, take one. Imperialism is the worst thing I've ever heard. Wait. And now a native New York impression, a New York echo. Hello! Shut the f*** up!
Mr. McGee!
A cheap shot, thank you.
Mr. McGee. Don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
Yes. We hope you like us when we're angry. I'm Dean Karyanis.
And I'm Owen Mugen. Welcome back to the Angry History Show.
We're recording this show on Tuesday, August 12th, 2014. Yesterday we got some very sad news for all of us that grew up in the 80s, aware of comedy, performance, anything, that Robin Williams had died.
It's awful, awful. And the very latest, according to preliminary findings announced at a press conference on Tuesday by Lieutenant Keith Boyd of the Marin County Sheriff's Office, is that Williams, 63, died from, quote, asphyxia due to hanging, end quote.
Yesterday, Robin Williams' widow, Susan Schneider, released the following statement on her husband's death. Quote, "This morning, I lost my husband and my best friend, while the world lost one of its most beloved artists and beautiful human beings. I am utterly heartbroken. On behalf of Robin's family, we are asking for privacy during our time of profound grief. As he is remembered, it is hoped that our focus will not be on Robin's death, but on the countless moments of joy and laughter he gave to millions," unquote.
Well, so let's do that then. You know, we know he was a super talent, Juilliard-trained, incredibly sharp mind. And when he landed on TV in the 70s, we really hadn't seen his like before.
And just to quickly set this scene up, for those of you who don't know the premise of the show, Mork is from space. He reports to Orson, who is his boss back on the home planet, an allusion to Orson Welles, and he arrives in a giant egg, and an egg is a continuing theme throughout the show. And in this case, he's just opened Pam Dauber, Mindy, her refrigerator, and found a carton of eggs, and so he's trying to set them free and communicate with them.
Hello? Little hatchling brothers, you must revolt against your oppressors. You have nothing to lose but your shells. As much as I like Mindy, it's against intergalactic law to eat fellow space travelers. Fly, be free! Well, I guess we'll have to have a quick burial at sea, then. I'll notify your next of kin. Your brother bit the big
This one. Is where most of us first met Robin Williams. High-pitched voice, wacky alien dude, born from the post-jump-the-shark era of Happy Days, on which he first appeared in 1978.
Hey, partner, that is some finger there you're packing, huh? Now, maybe we can work this out, just you and me, you know?
What is there to work out? It is settled. Come along, specimen.
Wait a minute. Let me tell you something. You ain't taking my buddy here. You gotta get through me first.
Oh, splendid. A hollytacker. I love a hollytacker.
What is a hall attacker?
In your language, specimen, it is a challenge. If your champion defeats me, you do not have to go with me.
All right, let me get this straight. If I win, you don't take the specimen here.
You read me, creature.
Creature? You want to rumble?
Rumble. Da-da-da-da-da. That is a hall attacker. Let us make it official. Then we must introduce the local celebrities. Gizadaba, Gibadaba, Zibadaba, Zibadaba, Gibadaba.
Can we get on with this now?
Anytime you're ready. I have been challenged on 200 planets. I am undefeated.
So am I.
I mean, what a face-off. Fonzie and a slightly threatening Mork. You know, it was really weird. And then Fonzie like invites Laverne in. He's gonna like, you know, he's gonna sacrifice his slut friend Laverne to this alien. He has no idea.
Hey, Laverne, other than that one time she woke up wearing some guy's boxer shorts, remained, that was a very pure show. Mr. DeFazio could sleep comfortably at night without worrying that anything.
But do you remember the episode in which they first appeared, Laverne and Shirley, in the Cunningham house? And they were definitely played as like slightly boozy hoe bags, and it was really well. But it's just so weird. Oh gosh, I mean, just this death of Williams is really, it certainly hit a lot of us very hard. And when you throw suicide into the mix, you know, someone who has been documentedly who'd been struggling with depression and substance for years, it's just, I just feel for the guy. Just to do that, to do that to yourself, to do that to your family. It's just so sad.
Yeah.
Really awful.
And yeah, people don't need a history show. And this guy played a big part here in television history. And
sure.
I think that maybe why some of his later roles, they sort of hammered him as a, gee, you can't even say a square or a round peg. I mean, the guy was his own shaped peg into the holes that already existed.
He was
unique. And that was the great thing about Mork and Mindy. I mean, they found a way to sort of adapt to him and follow him. And that's how great TV happens. You know, when you follow the talent and somebody with legitimate talent, not a lot of bells and whistles, at least in my opinion, everything that I've seen. I mean, the three cameras for I Love Lucy, that's what really brings out the genius when you look for those kind of things to be able to work a new medium, you know?
Yeah, and it's funny, you talk about the three cameras. Gary Marshall, who created Mork and Mindy and just about everything else of worth that we watched as kids, he had a very nice statement, and I'll read it now. Quote, "I'll never forget the day I met him, and he stood on his head in my office chair and pretended to drink a glass of water using his finger like a straw. The first season of Mork and Mindy, I knew immediately that a three-camera format would not be enough to capture Robin and his genius talent. So I hired a fourth camera operator, and he just followed Robin, only Robin. Looking back, four cameras weren't enough. I should have hired a fifth camera to follow him, too." I'm going to read the rest of Gary Marshall's statement. Quote, "Robin was hands down a comedy genius and one of the most talented performers I have ever worked with in television or film. To lose him so young at the age of 63 is just a tragedy. I will forever be in awe of his timing, his talent, and his pure and golden creativity. He could make everybody happy but himself. He was my friend, and it is rare that you ever have a friend that is also a genius." End quote.
It's
funny.
Yeah, I'm sorry. No, I was going to say, I'm listening to you and listening to him, and it's hard to sound sincere in these things sometimes.
Sure.
And people put them out. And when you hear people just, they have anecdotes, they have real reasons. It's not just generic things about him. And Pam Dauber, we have her statement, his co-star from Mork and Mindy. And if you haven't seen Mork and Mindy, which shockingly, there's many adult people, perhaps even in seats of power, who have never seen this show because of it's the future now. But his co-star was the lovely Pam Dauber. And she said, quote, "I am completely and totally devastated. What more can be said?" So I guess she's rendered speechless by it. And you could see why. They grew up. I mean, they were young. They were young by our standards now. I mean, we could probably be their parents by easily.
If you whip it back around. And it's true. I mean, like you said, people may not know it. The show went off the air 32 years ago.
Wow.
Which is weird.
That is
crazy. It's funny. You know, we were talking about this beforehand, and as you know, it didn't take us long to get to Star Trek. You look at Mork's costume in Mork and Mindy, and it's a great and wonderful combination of two amazing television shows. One, which is our personal favorite, and the other, another great anthology show. Why don't you explain the costume,
Dean? If you've seen the episode The Savage Curtain, which we referenced way back in that Presidential Misquotes episode with Abraham Lincoln, I think a lot of people even that don't watch Star Trek are familiar with the famous running into Lincoln floating in the middle of space.
Yeah. And, it's a pretty strong visual. You
know? Yeah. And so one of the characters there that was on the evil side, sort of a counter, was this Colonel Green, who was a really horrible military dictator, genocidal
big genocide guy.
And,
from what, the 90s? He wasn't from the 90s. It was like the early 21st century, wasn't he? Or maybe 20th.
I'm not sure.
Century.
We haven't seen him yet, so obviously it can't be the 90s.
Right?
That's true. Star Trek is really true. I mean, it's not just the show. So
you got to just wait something about Khan. I heard something about some guy who was one quarter ruler of the planet and took over 96. So they're keeping that under wraps, apparently.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you say that because there's actually a book, just to digress slightly, about Khan Nguyen Sung. It's called The Rise of Khan Nguyen Sung. And the book presupposes that, you know, President Clinton is president. All this was happening in the 90s when he was president. And the whole world was just covering it up, basically.
Sure.
And of course, it was the ozone hole because, you know, you can't have anything original. It has to be whatever the fear of the moment is, like the Khan was behind the ozone hole or whatever. I mean, I'm sure that the writer tried very hard. It just sounds crazy in retrospect. But the other show...
This planet is too cold and it vexes me.
Well, that's why he was doing those exercises all the time.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. And the other piece is The Outer Limits Helmet, or The Outer Limits was another anthology show that you may not be familiar with if you're younger.
And kind of like Twilight Zone.
Yeah, it was kind of like that. And the actor who played Kang, one of the original Klingons, plays a soldier from the future that's hurled back in time. It's kind of the best sci-fi, or sci-fi at its best. He gets hurled back and he wears this helmet. He's just a soldier. He's never had a family, anything. And the whole thing is the family that kind of adopts him in the past. This is the 60s. Right. They try to bring him into what for them is modern times and try to re-socialize him. And it's an interesting allegory. It's not like a lot of the other things. Anyway, it's his very futuristic space battle helmet that Mork is wearing. And we'll put these photos up at angryhistory.com and on Facebook because it's interesting. Colonel Green's uniform here from Star Trek, and then another great Star Trek actor in another role, his helmet reused from this Outer Limits episode.
Michael and Sarah, the late great. Yeah. And it's funny, it's one of those bit of, like, I think, semiotic imprinting when you're going to see those photos side by side, particularly of Colonel Green and Mork, and it's like, that's the same damn costume, you know? And as a kid who grew up on Star Trek and Mork and Mindy at the same time, I just never made the connection until I was much older.
It's Paramount, you know, or whoever.
Yeah, it's true.
You have, when you're there, you have a prop room, and there's a lot of those things that if you watch those old movies, you'll see all of a sudden, you'll say, wait a minute, that was, I mean, we've watched Star Trek exhaustive number of times, you'll say, wait a minute, they reused that.
Yep. We opened the show with a bit from his comedy album, his first comedy album, Reality, What a Concept. And well, see, I was a huge fan of Mork and Mindy when it came on, and a lot of us were. He was just so weird and cool, and it was space and all that, and he was just such an effervescent figure. And the show had Conrad Bain. What else could you possibly want?
Conrad Bain's twin brother? Sorry.
Yeah, that's true. Gosh, what a show that would be. And when I heard through my Aunt Judy, this is the same aunt who turned me on to all the Steve Martin comedy albums, when I heard that Mork had one, I wanted to hear it. And of course, I asked Mom and Dad. I was 9. And my folks vetoed it because of all the cursing. But I somehow managed to lobby them, and they allowed me to listen to it and love it. And I was listening to bits of it today, not having listened to it in such a long time. And it's amazing how just some of the things come back to you, like this bit in particular. Give a listen.
Now, a simpler poem, a poem written on acid entitled Abier. Abier. Amilabar. Eve Arden. Abier. Those of you who understood it went, wow, reality, what a concept. Now a poem for those of you who've taken Evan Wood's speed reading. Thank you. Who knew?
Boop. Thank you. Love it. He's just, you know, he was going. And I would love to know how much of that material he had actually had written down already, you know, versus just sort of going for it.
Yeah. Well, Norm Macdonald, a great Canadian comedian of the sort of current era, I guess you'd say, he tweeted out a series of just a recollection of the first time he met him. He's following him on The Tonight Show, and he keeps saying, the funniest man in the world here, I'm going to be following. And
I think it was Leno.
Okay.
Letterman.
And he goes and he just says, the guy comes in, hears me mention him to my friend he's kind of talking to on the phone and freaking out. And he picks up the phone. He spends 10 minutes with the guy. He starts pretending he's measuring his inseam. It's just all this crazy stuff. I mean, and that's all obviously ad-libbed. And I think that's one of the things, if you watch somebody with the sound off, we were talking about in our email string about this, how comedy clubs doesn't really have much of a luster for us, this sort of literal factory, with all due respect to the Laugh Factory, where they just churn things out. And Steve Martin's autobiography, Born Standing Up, he talks about this very Pavlovian response that sort of developed in comedy. And people were just laughing because it's a punchline, I'm supposed to laugh. And it was not really people interacting with you as an actor and you as a performer. And I think that's the thing Robin Williams really had down, because if you turn the sound off, even, you're laughing because there's so much physical comedy.
Right. His visuals were so great.
And for me, I was thinking, a good way to say it is people around the world knew him and saw his talent in Mrs. Doubtfire, whatever it was. But my grandmother, who passed away at 104, she started to lose her hearing there towards the end. She was still very sharp. She was still wrapping grape leaves and cooking all the Greek food, but she would watch TV because it was something we could do together because you can't have so much of a conversation. And she would watch, I mean, John Ritter loved him, Robin Williams. You can follow all of that no matter what the language is, even if you can't hear, there's something you're getting out of it because it's a true performance. It's not just hitting the marks out there.
No, it's true.
Natural mimic.
Absolutely. And here's another, I want to just throw another soundbite out from this album. Again, it's just, to me, it's so, these are like the imprints of things from when I was a kid. And I just, my wife Jackie was laughing her face off this morning because I was sort of just going beat for beat with him as we were listening to it. Here's another one, a great, a new wine. Here we go. Give a listen.
Thunderbird. Ah, but it's a good week though. Hello, Gore Vidal for Thunderbird Wine. Take two. Hello, Gore Thunderbird for Vidal Wine. Take three.
So strange. It's funny though. That album came out when he was right in the middle of his Mork sort of, you know, ascendance. And let's give a listen to a little bit of pushback from him.
Well, we talked about comedy clubs. I mean, here we go.
Yeah.
Here he is at the Improv, and here he is interacting. Here he is not grabbing the low-hanging fruit, you know, I mean, we love Alan Hale, but, you know, you don't want to be the guy at the door of your restaurant wearing the skipper hat doing that act for the rest of your life, necessarily.
I told you my brother John met Alan Hale.
Sure.
Out here 1,000 years ago, and of course, John was like, excuse me, aren't you you're Mr. Hale? And he goes, yes, well, most folks just call me Skipper, and John got a little sad for him, but I love Alan Hale.
Yeah.
Here's Williams ready to dish out some improv, doing a classic start to an improv routine, which is going to the audience for suggestions. Give a listen.
Well, time now to do some Shakespeare. A bit of culture. Yes, I'm sorry. We'll base this upon a subject, which I will get from you, an improvisational subject. Time's up. Anything special, current, topical in the news?
Robin Williams?
Yeah. Who's he? Yeah, what?
Mork.
No, no! No, my child! We are not doing that tonight, man! No, no, see, I'm free from that now, Master Bob! No, don't have to. Now, new for a while! We're doing something different. I'm going to be. 5 months ago, he couldn't say his own name. Thanks to your dollars, he's learned to go, no, 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 no. And you could have your very own series.
That's fine before Mark.
An angry mob. Shh, wait, time out. I have to explain one thing. I ain't doing the Mork because this is why I perform here, to do something different.
Robin Williams would move on from Mork and not do episodic television again until last year's short-lived The Crazy Ones. Just one season did he get of that.
Yep.
According to People magazine, that's a first and hopefully last for a history show, quoting People. Co-star Sarah Michelle Gellar said of Williams, quote, "To my children, he was Uncle Robin. To everyone he worked with, he was the best boss anyone had ever known. And to me, he was not just an inspiration, but he was the father I'd always dreamed of having."
Man, it's just sad. I mean, again, these people, we don't know them, whatever. I never met Williams myself, but it's just so many people are really feeling this.
I was going to mention a story, not firsthand, and we wanted to maybe get some people we know from San Francisco, particularly my friend Tom, who I went to high school with. He was friends with Williams, was privileged to meet him many times, he said, and he knows a lot of people that knew him very well through this world of cycling that he loved. And maybe we'll try to get some of those sound bites and add on to this at some point or share them with you, because I think it's a great point of view of a man that we don't always see. And I remember when I first saw Tom, and, you know, you run into a family friend, right, or a high school friend, and I saw him at the little bar there, the Creskill Tavern, where we've been hanging out for a long, long time. And we just were talking about various people and things that I do in the media and how different people are and personalities you work for. I said, hey, I saw that picture you had on Facebook, you and Robin Williams. You know, Tom's got his son strapped to his chest, which is weird because he's 18. But no, yeah. No. No.
Well, your friend Tom is also 15 feet tall. So
yeah. So he's just there with him. And he said, you know, what a regular guy. Like, he just came over, and I don't think about any of the politics or the addiction or any of the problems that he had. Then we didn't know how his life was tragically going to end. He's the kind of guy who can talk to anyone, is Tom. Right. Why don't we ride together? It's like, that's awesome. All right, sure. You know, and he's like, he came over to my house, rode me there, and I figured he would go. And instead he's like, oh, can I have a glass of water? Comes in. He's like, he gets right down on the floor with my kids, you know, and just starts playing with them.
That's great.
And I thought that when we talked there about Sarah Michelle Gellar and how her kids considered him Uncle Robin, I can see that from that story. He said it was just the most genuine thing. He wasn't on. He was just, there's two young children here, you know, like I'm going to play with the most natural thing in the world. And that's such a, that's a beautiful way to remember the guy. And I hope that we can, he's going to help us hopefully get some of those recollections. Cause I feel like there's so many people are going to focus on all the performances, but something like bike riding, when someone has that, Paul Newman with his racing cars, those are things where they step out of it. And Robin Williams eventually, of course, did go into films, and, you know, he did a ton of films. You know, there were some classics. There were some, as we talked about, that just missed the mark, that weren't ready. He kept pushing and trying. And I always love that about any performer, you know, when they try. When, you know, Bill Murray does, he had to really push to and negotiate and wheedle to do Razor's Edge because he wanted to do a dramatic movie about World War I.
We don't want you to be something we don't know.
Right.
But yeah, and it's true. They're like World's Greatest Dad, which is, you know, a dark comedy from Bobcat Goldthwait a couple years ago. The Angriest Man in Brooklyn, which is fairly recent. I definitely want to put those on the list. Anyway, here's a random bit of weirdness from some more awesome Williams stand-up. Give a listen.
Elmer Fudd sings Bruce Springsteen.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio. I pull you a little closer. You say no. You say you don't like it. I say you're a wire. But when we get, it's like fire.
You know, we can riff on a few of these, certainly. You know, Fisher King, you were saying you were watching a bit of earlier today, right?
Yeah, I came home and I said, well, we had a little time before we decided to print this up. And I said, let me flick that on. Terry Gilliam is that, an adaptation, wanted to do
Terry
something.
Terry Gilliam is the best.
And so awesome. Speaking of a little British comedy, I was thinking of Benny Hill before when I talked about being able to watch stuff with my yaya that was grandmother in Greek. She, you know, that she could see physical comedy and laugh at and think was fun.
Right.
It's like that was very much in that. And they were able to work together in this. And yet it wasn't strictly a comedy role. I mean, he's playing dramatic and he could do it.
Tragic.
Good Morning Vietnam, World According to Garp. I mean, a lot of these films he lifted up. And the one that they said today, well, possibly his creepiest role in one of the stories, and I don't know what could be creepier than 1 hour photo. He's like, I don't know, Aladdin. Yeah, that was much creepier than a guy with the, if you haven't seen that movie, I won't spoil it, but it's good for him. He's trying it, you know. He wasn't doing it at that point, as we're hearing a little bit now by people secondhand that maybe some of his finances weren't great. He wanted to do something different and he had the talent to do it.
Yep. I remember World According to Garp, which we were talking about, you know, an email, was what a strange film it was. I remember seeing it when I was a kid because, you know, you wanted to devour everything about a guy who you loved, like Williams. And I just remember, though, there was a particular scene where their young son gets killed and just his reaction, his take, it kind of still haunts me, you know, all these years later. I think the line reading was, I miss Walt, you know, it was just one line, but it was rough.
And everything leading up to that, really, him and his wife, because the thing was about his wife was cheating on him. And he'd figured out, and he had the kids in the car, and he was driving down, and they used to do this thing where he would turn the lights off.
Oh, you mean in the movie?
Yeah, in the movie, his character, Garp. And so he, that's how the son died. And
that's right. He went off, hands off the brake. That's right. And wasn't she performing an act on the guy with whom she was cheating? And then it acted like a guillotine. Yeah,
it was one of her students, I believe, from the school. Oh, it was very strange. But they didn't talk for a while, and they would show that. And then he comes to her and he says that, you know, about missing Duncan's the other son. Why? Right. I mean, this stuff sticks with you, even though this is not, as you said, a movie that fits into a beginning, middle, and end. But he elevated so many of these films just because you love to watch the guy on the screen, even if 20 years later, I mean, you may not be talking about it or ever remember it. His performance in the movie Dead Again, for example, he has
You were hot on that today. Yeah. I had totally forgotten about that.
Yeah, he has a little just tiny piece there. You know, he plays a disgraced psychologist. He's having a conversation with Kenneth Branagh in a freezer. Mm-hmm. He's quizzing him, and there's just this one part, and I think of this often in various circumstances over the last 20 years, where he says, "You want a cigarette?" And he says, "No, I don't smoke." And he says, "Well, by my count, you've been in here 3 minutes. You've looked at this pack of cigarettes 20 times. You want a cigarette?" And he says, "No, I'm not. I'm not. I'm trying to quit." And keep in mind, his character's this disgraced psychologist who's been caught having sex with a patient. And he says, don't tell me you're trying. He says, you know, you're either are a smoker or you're not a smoker. It's like, find what you are and be that. And he says, trying is for, and he uses a crude word that I'll leave out, that's, you know, who can't commit. And right. I've thought that like about things, and it's true because, you know, and you'll apply it when you see it. And that's not a big, huge role. It's just a little cameo that he did.
No, it's true. It was really impactful. Another one of his movies that I really liked a lot, and it was such an odd film to me, and I didn't know anything about Robert Altman, you know, when I first saw Popeye as a kid, and except that it was a strange movie, you know, and of course, you know, we all knew Popeye, and we watched it, and, you know, but this was a really, really interesting, and I would say it had some shades of darkness to it, too. This take on the Popeye thing, but Williams himself was just so great. He was so awesome. He was so appealing, and he really helped get me interested in films of Altman and lots of other stuff. But I think, you know, Williams had, like we mentioned, some films we weren't nuts about. Like for me, Patch Adams, Jacob the Liar, you know, they'll give you diabetes if you're not careful. It's just kind of too much schmaltz for some people's tastes. But if you want to look at a film, and this is the one that we'll play a bit of sound from, to give you an example of the man's potential for dramatic excellence, for his Oscar-winning role in 1997's Good Will Hunting, won Best Supporting Actor, in which he played Matt Damon's shrink. This is Williams and Damon on a park bench after a particularly hard session between them. Give a listen.
What's this? The taste's choice moment between guys?
This is really nice. You got a thing for swans? Is this like a fetish? It's something like maybe we need to devote some time to?
Thought about what you said to me the other day about my painting. Huh? Stayed up half the night thinking about it. Something occurred to me. I fell into a deep, peaceful sleep and haven't thought about you since. You know what occurred to me?
No.
You're just a kid. You don't have the faintest idea what you're talking about.
Why, thank you.
It's all right. You've never been out of Boston.
Nope.
So if I asked you about art, you'd probably give me the skinny on every art book ever written. Michelangelo. I know a lot about him. Life's work, political aspirations, him and the Pope, sexual orientation, the whole works, right? I bet you can't tell me what it smells like in the Sistine Chapel. You never actually stood there and looked up at that beautiful ceiling. Seen that. If I ask you about women, you'd probably give me a silver, say your personal favorites. You may have even been laid a few times. You can't tell me what it feels like to wake up next to a woman and feel truly happy. You're a tough kid. I ask you about war, you'd probably throw Shakespeare at me, right? Once more into the breach, dear friends. But you've never been near one. You've never held your best friend's head in your lap and watch him gasp his last breath looking to you for help. I ask you about love, you'd probably quote me a sonnet. But you've never looked at a woman and been totally vulnerable. Known someone that could level you with her eyes. feeling like God put an angel on earth just for you. Who could rescue you from the depths of hell. And you wouldn't know what it's like to be her angel. To have that love for her be there forever. Through anything. Through cancer. And you would know about sleeping, sitting up in a hospital room for 2 months, holding her hand, because the doctors could see in your eyes that the terms visiting hours don't apply to you. You don't know about real loss, because that only occurs when you love something more than you love yourself. I doubt you've ever dared to love anybody that much. I look at you, I don't see an intelligent, confident man. I see a cocky, scared kid. But you're a genius, Will. No one denies that. No one could possibly understand the depths of you. But you presume to know everything about me because you saw a painting of mine. You ripped my fucking life apart. You're an orphan, right? Do you think I'd know the first thing about how hard your life has been? How you feel? Who you are? Because I read Oliver Twist. Does that encapsulate you? Personally, I don't give a shit about all that, because you know what? I can't learn anything from you. I can't read in some fucking book. Unless you want to talk about you. Who you are. And I'm fascinated. I'm in. But you don't want to do that, do you, Sport? You're terrified of what you might say. Your move, Chief.
Yep, your move, Chief. It's interesting, you know, one thing I read today, and I didn't realize that he was a big online gamer. I knew he liked video games, but apparently he was, you know, big into Call of Duty Online, World of Warcraft, and for the escapism, and there was just an interesting, and we'll throw a link up to it, I think it's a Salon article, of just about how the people in that community are remembering this guy, someone who they loved, not just for his TV work, but because he was, you know, kind of one of them, you know, a cool game nerd. But he named his daughter Zelda after the old Nintendo classic Legend of Zelda, which I thought was really cool. And there's a statement from her 25-year-old daughter. He has two other children he left behind. Zelda quoting the Little Prince, quote, you alone will have the stars as no one else has them. In one of the stars I shall be living. In one of them I shall be laughing. And so it will be as if all the stars were laughing when you look at the night sky. You, only you, will have the stars that can laugh. I love you. I miss you. I'll try to keep looking up. Z, end quote. Ugh.
Yeah, it's really heartbreaking, and you can't really add anything to it. And all we can do is, I guess everybody, even if it's just on a little podcast or even if it's you on the bus, is reach out to people you think might have this kind of problem. I mean, we can all spend 2 minutes in the million stories we read a day, especially when you're reading about people that have passed away maybe 100, 200 years ago, like myself. But it's, you know, one veteran kills himself every hour. For instance, and that's just something that sort of came to me as I was sitting there watching the movie and thinking about it. You know, of course, we hear a lot about people that are homeless that have served. It's like it's just incredible. And it also, again, just doing a little bit of reading about it, it trickles down to the spouses. They Blue Star families. They surveyed 5,100 military families, found 9% of military spouses had considered suicide. And if they're admitting it, there's such a stigma against it that we all
there is.
You know,
that
it's got to be higher.
Yeah. It's got
to
be higher.
We all just say, I mean, hey, we all get depressed. I mean, you know, I certainly get depressed. It's like, it's not enough to tell somebody, hey, come on, feel better, cheer up. It's because that's the thing. And I thought of it, you know, coming from a medical background. And I said, for me, the metaphor, and I love metaphors to explain things, is if someone's drunk or they're under substance, you know, some kind of substance, you know, they're a sleeping pill, whatever, they're tired. You don't just say, oh, hey, come on, wake up, and expect them to wake up, or hey, come on, be sober. And you can't do it for yourself either. Like, you say, hi, this guy had everything going for him. How could he do this?
Right.
But we've all looked in the mirror and said, come on, be sober. So, you know, sure. Even though you know you can't, you've had seven beers. And this is a real chemical imbalance for people. And, you know, you were mentioning Popeye. I remember every time I hear that movie, I think of watching it in my aunt and godmother, my nuna, as we say in Greek, Adamandia, in her bedroom in Fort Lee, you know, right down from where my grandmother was. She would let us go in there if the kids just wanted to watch something. She was bipolar. She was manic depressive. She was on many medications to try to control it in her life. And it's a real mental illness. Again, this is a history show. But if you were 100 years ago or 200 years ago, you didn't have access to the help that's out there now. And I think it's great that we live in a time where hopefully if you're willing to access it and maybe help somebody, you know, you'll never know who it is just to be a little bit kind.
Absolutely. And you are so right about that. And it's one of those things, and you hear it a million times, and we've all seen it the past day at the bottom of websites, you know, take it seriously, take it seriously. Yes, do take it seriously. Do reach out. Don't, if you hear someone speaking this way, they're probably not joking, you know? But we have this problem of sort of competing ideals, this one of man up or woman up, you know, be tough, stiff upper lip, versus the true reality that this is a disease that people have a hard time controlling. And sometimes, like it seems to be the case with this guy who we all have a lot of fondness for, he couldn't help himself.
Yeah.
For all the help that he had at his disposal, it wasn't enough. Yeah. Poor guy, you know? I want to turn it up around here just a little bit before we start to segue out of this show. You talk about your friend Tom and how good Williams was with the young audience of those children. My son, who is going to be four, you know, we started to let him watch certain things, like a little bit of Sesame Street here or there. And there's all of a sudden, one bleary-eyed morning, I'm sitting there watching Sesame Street with him, and then Robin Williams comes on with the two-headed monster. So just picture as you're listening to this, it's Robin in full beard mode. He's a hairy guy, and he looks awesome, though. He's got a huge beard. Looks like Moses, you know? And standing there with the equally awesome two-headed monster, and they're going to give us a lesson about conflict.
Hello, I'm Robin, and this is the two-headed monster.
Hello!
And we're here to tell you all about the word conflict.
Conflict!
Right, conflict. You guys ready to show conflict?
Ready!
Okay, here we go. The two-headed monster showing us conflict.
Bajabalena chiki kosovo! Oh, igedemo odamadu!
Wait! Time out, guys! Guys, I'm not sure you understand. We need to show everyone conflict.
Conflict!
Right, but I'm afraid that wasn't conflict.
No conflict.
No, you see, a conflict is when two people fight or disagree about something, and they have a conflict.
Oh, conflict!
Yeah, conflict!
Okay, great.
Conflict.
We're ready to try again? Okay, here we go. The two-headed monster is now going to show us conflict. Take two.
Bonifacio, mine.
One of them has a flower he says is his. That's a promising start. Looks like the other one wants the same flower. This could be some conflict.
Vegetable ball. Share?
Oh, they're sharing.
Stop.
Look, that was very nice. That was lovely, actually. You were sharing, and that warms the cockles of my heart. But listen, my fuzzy two-headed friend, that was not conflict.
No conflict. No conflict.
I'm just sorry, it wasn't.
No conflict.
Wait,
what?
I just realized something.
What?
We disagree. We're arguing about something.
So?
We're having a conflict.
Conflict?
Conflict!
And I love the look of that on the screen. And you posted that at our Angry History Facebook page.
Yeah, yeah.
Just that he's going out there with this crazy beard and he's sort of, it's just a really great way to be able to relate to people like that. And it's tough to think you can't always lift yourself up like that. You know, I mean, we played that in the Martin Luther King episode where he said, you know, he's sitting next to this man and he says, a white man, he says, and he's asking me the problem with your people is this. And he says, I tried to find some common ground with him and say, well, let me explain it to you. This is why it's easy to tell someone to pull up from their bootstraps, but the black man's color has become a stigma. And it's sort of similar with this in the sense that, you know, there's a stigma against that asking for help. And it's from the outside. It's not necessarily from the inside. And for all of us, you got to be more empathetic, I guess, because we all find it hard to believe because we couldn't do it. I mean, I go across that George Washington Bridge every day. 13 people, including also a member from, Creskill High School, one of the guy graduated a few years above us, but actually this same Tom, his brother's best friend. And he was the 13th guy that just jumped. And nobody can imagine that. No one can imagine going to that edge. And it's hard to imagine. I mean, we may say we can or think we can, but that's the thing. When someone tells you that, like you said, you have to take it seriously, you know? And I guess it's human nature just to go, meh. But,
Oh, they're looking for attention. Oh, they're drunk. Oh, they're whatever, you know. Or they're seriously ill and you hate to hear it. It's over and over again. A cry for help, but that may be what it is. You know, we're not medical professionals, but we hope to at least try to be, you know, people with feelings who can keep our eyes open, because sometimes that's the only way someone's going to get some help is if a friend notices. Or like we said again, all the help in the world may not change an outcome.
Or like, so. I mean, look, we talked about the disease that Harold Ramis had when we did our previous one of these kind of obits, you know, historic figures in entertainment, if you will, but he had a disease. We couldn't help anybody else who has it, really. There's nothing that you can do. And probably it was very rare. But I guess that's why, even though this is, again, a history show, you think about ways you can help. And when you read those things, too, like, that's part of history. It's sad. It's sad to look at his work now and think this, that this is how the guy went. Because I don't know. I think I feel a little bit guilty consuming it sometimes because you feel like, gosh, I'm getting so much from this guy. And
that's right.
You know, so little that he kept for himself.
Yeah, it's true. But I want to give one final remembrance. This is one from Chevy Chase. Quote, Robert and I were great friends, suffering from the same little-known disease, depression. I never could have expected this ending to his life and to ours with him. God bless him, and God bless us all for his life. I cannot believe this, and I'm overwhelmed with grief. What a wonderful man-boy, what a tremendous talent in the most important art of any time, comedy. I loved him. End quote.
I'm Dean Karyanis.
I'm Owen Mugen. We'll talk to you guys next time. Thanks for listening.
Mark calling Orson. Come in, Orson. Mark calling Orson. Come in, Orson.
Mark calling Orson. Come in, you blimpship.
Here I am, Mark. What did you do this week?
Oh, sir, I played the Wizard of Oz. I gave the Tin Man a heart.
Is that another of your weird analogies?
Oh, no, sir, just a movie metaphor. See, what actually happened, sir, is there was this robot. He was nothing but a bunch of nuts and bolts, and I helped him become a person.
You built a monster?
No, sir. I made a friend.
If you made a friend, why are you so sad?
Well, sir, I lost him.
Can't you make another?
Oh, sir. Well, I could, but I haven't got the heart for it.
What do you mean?
Well, sir, you know when you create someone and you nurture them, they grow. Well, there comes a time when they have to lead their own life. Or die their own death.
And now your friend is gone forever?
Oh, no, sir. No. I'll always keep him right here.